Now we continue with the 2008 interview. This is Democracy Now! Interviewing Philip Shannon on his book about the 9/11 Commission.
I'm Amy Goodman, the executive director of the Federal 9/11 Commission. Philip Zelikow had much closer ties to the Bush administration than publicly disclosed. This is according to an explosive new book by New York Times investigative reporter Philip Sheenan. It's called The Commission, the Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. The book goes on sale today, but has already created quite a stir in Washington. Philip Sheenan alleges Zelikow had close ties to both Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and political advisor Karl Rove, suggesting he sought to minimize the Bush administration's responsibility for failing to prevent the September 11th attacks. New York Times investigative reporter and author Philip Sheenan joins us now here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Joining us in Washington, D.C. Can you start off beginning where you began in your book, with the story of Sandy Berger?
Well, in 2002, Sandy Berger, on behalf of President Clinton, was asked to go to the National Archives to begin reviewing the Clinton administration's most secret national security papers to prepare for all the investigations that everyone assumed were coming on 9/11. And it appears that in his very early travels to the National Archives, he began stealing documents. He began stealing, in particular, one document that had been prepared in 2001. Many of his friends and admirers believe that he stole this document because he believed wrongly that he was somehow, or he and the Clinton administration were somehow going to be scapegoated for 9/11.
Talk about what he took, what he stuffed into his socks and pockets, and how he was discovered.
He kept stealing the same document. It was a report prepared by Richard Clark, who you'll recall at the time was the president's counterterrorism czar. He served that function both in the Clinton and in the Bush administrations. Berger had tasked him after a series of terrorist threats at the time of the millennium to prepare a long list of recommendations for how the nation should better prepare itself for terrorist threats. Clark did as he was asked to and prepared a very long list, apparently 29 pages, or rather 29 recommendations. Berger may have believed, or at least people who know about the investigation believe, that he thought that because some of these recommendations had not been acted on by the time the Clinton administration left office, that somehow he, Berger, and President Clinton would be blamed for having left the nation vulnerable on 9/11. And again, over a period of more than a year, during several visits to the National Archives, whenever Berger finds this document, he steals it. There are several copies of it he steals.
And what happened to him?
The archive staff became alarmed early on in one of the early visits that something was wrong. Berger kept making frequent trips to the men's room, seemingly that were unnecessary. One staffer sees him in the hallway with what appears to be papers rolled around his socks. The archive staff figures they've got to sort of test Berger, and they begin numbering the documents. They begin with a pencil. They place numbers on the back of all the documents that are given to Berger, and on a later visit, they determine that indeed there are documents missing. They can determine it pretty quickly. They call in they let the White House know that this is happening. The White House lets the Justice Department know that this is happening, and Berger finds himself the subject of a criminal investigation quickly.
Let's talk about Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. First, tell us how it was formed, and then his control of the commission.
The commission was formed by a law passed in Congress in 2002 after long and very tortured debate. It was a 10-member panel, five Democrats, five Republicans. The only person for the commission chosen by the White House was the chairman, initially Henry Kissinger. Kissinger stepped down, and he was replaced by Tom Kaine, the governor of New Jersey. Democratic leaders in the House and Senate chose their five representatives. Early on, after Governor Kaine came on board, there was a search for an executive director, somebody to run the investigation on a day-to-day basis. There's a polite fiction in Washington that the reports of blue ribbon commissions are written by the blue ribbon commissioners. Well, that's not usually the case. They're usually written by a professional staff led by a congressional researcher or a scholar. In this case, Cain and Hamilton came across the resume quite early on of Philip Zelikow, a very well-respected historian at the University of Virginia. They contact him, and Zelikow agrees to come on board.
And he had served on the Blue Ribbon Commission investigating the 2000 vote that got Bush selected.
Exactly, and he had earned the praise of both Republicans and Democrats on that commission. It's one of the commissioners from the Electoral Reform Commission who joins the 9/11 Commission and forwards Zelikow's name to Cain and Hamilton. And as I say, Zelikow comes on board quite early.
You talk about in your book the commission that's just being released this week, just being released today, Zelikow's secret relationship with Karl Rove. He's this week becoming a commentator on Fox News, but much more relevant was his top status within the White House, top advisor to President Bush.
Well, what I can tell you is that in 2003, Karl Rove called Zelikow a number of times at the commission. We know this because there are phone logs recording Rove's calls in. Now, Zelikow had a lot of ties to the Bush administration, and that was known to some degree when he signed on to the investigation. And he had assured the commission that he would do his best to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest and would cut off most of these ties with his friends in the White House and elsewhere. It becomes known on the commission staff in 2003 that despite these promises, Zelikow is having conversations with, of all people, Karl Rove. And this creates, as you might imagine, a huge amount of alarm and suspicion on the commission staff. You know, what is the executive director of the 9/11 commission doing talking to Karl Rove? Now, Rove's people at the White House, you know, his friends and allies there, and Zelikow insist that this was completely innocent and that this involved Zelikow's work at the University of Virginia. And indeed, Zelikow's work at the University of Virginia centered around presidential histories. So Karl Rove is somebody he would have normally at the university had some sort of contact with, I assume. And there's a odd development thereafter, which is Zelikow calls in his secretary, shuts the door, and informs her that she is no longer to keep phone logs of his contacts with the White House. The secretary is alarmed by this, worries that she's being asked to do something improper, and then contacts the chief lawyer for the commission to alert him to what's happened. As I say, this whole sequence creates a great alarm and a great suspicion about what Zelikow was up to.
We're talking to Philip Sheehan. His book has just come out. It's called The Commission. His relationship, Philip Zelikow's relationship with Condoleezza Rice, how far back does it go, and what does it mean for the ultimate report that comes out?
Well, they have a relationship that goes way back. They were both members of the National Security Council staff in the first Bush administration, Bush 41. They formed a close friendship at that point. After that presidency, Zelikow goes off to Harvard and Rice returns to Stanford, yet they stay in touch and they write a book together about German reunification. After President Bush, the 43, enters the White House. He sets up a transition team for the National Security Council at Rice's recommendation, and Rice tasks Zelikow to join the transition team, specifically with responsibility for reviewing counterterrorism operations at the White House. Now, some of this was known at the time of Zelikow's hiring. I think the question is how much of that was known. And, of course, Rice was at the heart of the 9/11 Commission investigation. You know, it was her actions in the spring and summer of 2001 that were among the most important subjects for investigation by the 9/11 Commission. Yet the commission was being run on a day-to-day basis by somebody who was undeniably a very close friend of hers.
I want to go to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice publicly testifying before the 9/11 Commission. It was April 8, 2004, an exchange between Rice and Commissioner Richard Benveniste.
You acknowledged to us in your interview of February 7, 2004, that Richard Clark told you that Al-Qaeda cells were in the United States. did you tell the president at any time prior to August 6th of the existence of al-Qaeda cells in the United States?
First, let me just make certain.
If you could just answer that question, first, because I only have a very limited...
I understand, Commissioner, but it's important that I also address... It's also important, Commissioner, that I address the other issues that you have raised. So I will do it quickly, but if you'll just give me a moment.
Well, my only question to you is whether you
I understand,
told
Commissioner,
the president.
But I will, if you'll just give me a moment, I will address fully the questions that you've asked. First of all, yes, the August 6th PDB was in response to questions of the president. In that sense, he asked that this be done. It was not a particular threat report. And there was historical information in there about various aspects of al-Qaeda's operations. Dick Clark had told me, I think in a memorandum, I remember it as being only a line or two, that there were al-Qaeda cells in the United States. Now, the question is, what did we need to do about that? And I also understood that that was what the FBI was doing, that the FBI was pursuing these al-Qaeda cells. I believe in the August 6th memorandum it says that there were 70 full field investigations underway of these cells. And so there was no recommendation that we do something about this. The FBI was pursuing it. I really don't remember, Commissioner, whether I discussed this with the president. I remember very well that the president was aware that there were issues inside the United States. He talked to people about this, but I don't remember the al-Qaeda cells as being something that we were told we needed to do something about.
Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6th PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
Condoleezza Rice being questioned by Richard Benveniste of the 9/11 Commission. The significance of this interchange, Philip Sheehan.
Well, those were probably the five most dramatic moments in the 2 years I covered the commission. Well, there was a rather remarkable document that was handed to President Bush in August 2001, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. It was it's the daily brief. The president receives sort of a super secret newspaper every morning that has the most important news the CIA wants to get across to him. And that was the headline on the PDB on August 6, 2001, just, you know, a month before 9/11. And the question is why, after the president and Rice got this document, they didn't do much more to try to prepare for the possibility of a domestic terrorist strike. Now, I will tell you, the August 6 PDB, you can make too much of it and you can make too little of it. A lot of the information in the PDB was wrong. A lot of it was historical, that dated back several years. But there were some fairly specific current warnings, current intelligence suggesting that something was going on. And it actually refers to concerns that terrorists might be conducting surveillance of the skyline of New York City and that hijacked planes might somehow be involved in whatever threat was underway.
And what ultimately got reported in the commission report of Condoleezza Rice, what she knew, when she knew it, what effect did Philip Zelikow have on that?
Well, Zelikow apparently used the term Clark-centric. He kept telling the staff that he thought the report that they were writing was too Clark-centric, too much drawn from and defending the position of Richard Clark, who had argued, rather explosively in 2004 that President Bush and Condi Rice had ignored his warnings that something terrible was about to happen.
How did the Bush administration try to destroy Richard Clark's credibility?
Well, they had quite a campaign going both publicly and behind the scenes to lead the public to believe that Richard Clark was making these damning allegations, either because he was a very partisan Democrat who wanted to see President Bush ousted from the White House in the elections that November. And they also engaged in a behind-the-scenes attack to feed questions to the 9/11 Commission that they thought would undermine Clark's credibility.
Philip, I wanted to play for you the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, denying claims that Zelikow worked to minimize the Bush administration's responsibility for failing to prevent the 9/11 attacks.
We found him to be very fair-minded, quite impartial, very rigorous in his searching out of the facts, and he certainly did not try to protect the Bush administration or to protect anybody else.
That was the 9/11 Commission Vice Chair Lee Hamilton, interviewed on NBC's Nightly News. Philip Sheehan.
Congressman Hamilton has always, throughout the investigation, was a big champion of Dr. Zelikow's. Mr. Hamilton was very much involved in the decision to hire Dr. Zelikow in the first place. I will tell you that I think there are a large number of people on the commission staff, at least, who would certainly disagree with Congressman Hamilton.
In your book, Philip Sheehan, you write about Attorney General Ashcroft and how he tried to mount an attack on a member of the commission to defer criticism that he refused to listen to reports about al-Qaeda threats.
Well, I will that attack, it's a bit of an irony that John Ashcroft, who was treated very harshly by the 9/11 Commission in its appraisal of his performance, was really the man who maybe more than anyone else is responsible for the unanimity of the 9/11 Commission at the end. The commission was prepared to make very serious charges against Ashcroft, that he had essentially ignored terrorist threats in the spring and summer of 2001, that he had actually told the FBI that he didn't want to hear anything more about al-Qaeda. He didn't feel he could do anything about it. The FBI was pretty—was astounded by that declaration from Ashcroft. But Ashcroft's strategy then was to mount a counterattack, and he mounted a counterattack against Jamie Gorelick, one of the Democratic commissioners on the commission, who had been deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. And Ashcroft made public some memos from the Clinton administration that he said showed that Gorelick was responsible for so many of the problems that the FBI and the Justice Department faced in 2001 in not being able to respond to terrorist attacks. The commissioners, to a person, found Ashcroft's attack to be wildly unfair and really rallied behind Gorelick. And really, as I say, Ashcroft's attack is really what brought the commissioners together at the end to produce a unanimous report.
And what about Max Cleland, the senator from Georgia, who served on the commission? What happened to him?
He was, you know, easily the most partisan Democrat on the commission. He believed that the 9/11 that the 9/11 commission needed to get to the bottom of why so many people in the Bush administration appeared to have bungled intelligence in the spring and summer of 2001. And perhaps more importantly for Cleland, he thought the commission needed to try to figure out if the Bush administration had taken the nation to war in 2003 in Iraq on the basis of faulty intelligence, that it had sort of rigged the case against Iraq, trying to link it to al-Qaeda. The commission very much—the commission's leadership very much didn't want to take on those issues, and they became so alarmed by Cleland's outbursts and his obvious disdain for President Bush and for Karl Rove in particular, that they looked for a way to ease him off the investigation, and they were successful at that. Cleland was offered a job elsewhere in the federal government and left the panel. Now, Cleland will tell you that it was his decision, absolutely, to get off the commission. He thought it was on the verge of a whitewash, and he wanted off. But regardless, he leaves the scene, and former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry joins the commission in his place.
What about the vice president, Dick Cheney, then and now?
Well, he plays a big role in much of this story. Cheney was really at the forefront of efforts to try to stop the 9/11 commission from being created in the first place. He was unsuccessful at that, obviously. He becomes important later on when the commission begins to investigate what happened at the White House on the morning of September 11th. Most importantly, the question with regards to Cheney was, why did he authorize the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11 to begin shooting down passenger planes if they approached Washington, D.C. Cheney was at the White House. The president was in Florida. Cheney, claiming he was acting at the authorization of the president, told the Pentagon to be prepared to shoot down passenger planes. And he insisted, he being the vice president, insisted to the 9/11 commission that he had only issued this order after consultation with the president and after receiving the president's approval. The commission staff, and I think most of the commissioners, become convinced over time that that account is just not true, that the vice president issued the shoot-down order without any authorization from the president, an act that would almost certainly be unconstitutional. The vice president really has no role in military decision-making. If there was a shoot-down order issued, it should have been issued either by the president or by the defense secretary in his place. The commission, if you read between the lines of the 9/11 commission report, I think you can see that they didn't believe the vice president.
We're talking to Philip Sheenan, investigative reporter with the New York Times, has just come out with the book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. It comes from his years of reporting on the commission as well as the aftermath. Can you talk about where Bob Kerry stood, who replaced Max Cleland? The reports are that he almost quit when he heard about Zelikow's connections to Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice.
Kerry joins the commission in December of 2003. There are really only several months left in the investigation at that point. He cancels his Christmas vacation with his wife in Italy, and he gets on the train and comes down to Washington and begins reading up on what's in the commission's files. And on the very first day he begins going through the files, he comes across a memo that Zelikow had apparently prepared listing all of his ties to the Bush administration, his friendship with Condi Rice, his involvement on the transition team, the fact that he had written the 2002 preemptive war strategy for the White House that would be used to justify the Iraq war in 2003.
Explain that.
We have to backtrack a bit, but
right.
In 2002, this is before the creation of the 9/11 Commission, Condoleezza Rice contacts Zelikow at the University of Virginia and asks him to prepare a document for the White House that would justify a preemptive war, an attack against an enemy that did not necessarily pose an immediate threat to the United States. In many ways, it would be a document that would turn American military doctrine on its head. Zelikow does this and produces quite a masterfully written a memo that's called the National Security Strategy of the United States, issued in September in 2002. And very few people know that this document was written by Philip Zelikow of the University of Virginia. That really wouldn't be well known for another 2 years. Now, bringing the story forward a bit, Bob Kerry comes across the memo listing all of Zelikow's ties to the White House and his contacts and his friendships, and announces immediately to Tom Kaine, the chairman of the commission, that it's either him or me. Zelikow goes or I go. How could you possibly have hired somebody with so many conflicts of interest to run this investigation?
President Bush, talk about the unique circumstances under which President Bush and Vice President Cheney testified before the commission.
Well, for most of the life of the 9/11 commission, the president and the vice president had no intention of meeting with the 9/11 commission. They argued that it was not the president's place to be involved in that sort of questioning. And there was some history there. That President Lyndon Johnson had refused to answer questions from the Warren Commission, at least face-to-face. At the end of the day, political pressures were such that the president and the vice president, Bush and Cheney, agreed to meet with all 10 members of the 9/11 Commission. They would only meet with the commissioners if they could appear together. The questioning could not be under oath, and it could not be recorded in any way. And it took place in the spring of 2004, just a couple of months before the commission finished its work.
Wasn't the most astounding part of that it wasn't under oath?
Well, I, again, as I say, there's no history of presidents being required to submit to questioning like this. And you know, the White House had a strong argument in many ways. President Johnson was not required to submit to similar questioning, and certainly not under oath, before the Warren Commission that was investigating the assassination of his predecessor.
A potentially interesting parallel there in terms of deep state events with the Warren Commission, another supposedly investigative body, which didn't seem to come up with much, with people like the National Security Advisor being charged with destroying documents and removing evidence from the National Archive. Who knows what went on that didn't come to light? There's obviously some kind of warring sets of factions when they appoint somebody to the commission who then resigns in disgust. What are we to make of this entire process? Certainly wouldn't require a great deal of input to allow a democratic selection of people to investigate what went on. But then, if finding the truth was really what these commissions were about, then national security wouldn't be waived at every turn as the overriding principle. Whose security is this? Are we talking the 99.999% of people? Or are we talking the very few in government whose dirty deeds are apparently too dangerous to leave anywhere accessible? Do you feel more secure because of the national security doctrine? Because if most of us don't, why do we put up with it? That doctrine springs from people's fear of one another. There's some wicked Muslim bogeyman out there going to bomb you if we tell you our secrets. Well, I don't believe these secrets. I think these are people operating in narrow self-interest, and they don't actually care about protecting the 99% or the 99.9999%, to give it a truer name. And I think the hypocrisy of this is becoming clear to people by the day as they see what goes on in the Occupy movements, how it's suddenly become a health hazard to be camping outside when it wasn't a health hazard for 2 months. How they clear a park at 1 in the morning, giving people 20 minutes notice. How they say they're going to take their belongings away and return them later, yet they put them in a crusher. Or do we say, well, these things have always gone on, so we've got to expect it to go on? Do we say, no, this is not acceptable? The law category on our website has dozens of episodes in it which show that injustice has very frequently been enshrined into law. Do we then bow down and worship it, or do we kick it over and say, this is nonsense? I don't think we should be using historical precedent as any kind of justification where it contradicts common sense. What's the point in having people testify if they're not testifying under oath? And why have them testify at all if you're not actually writing it down and recording it? We don't say, oh, well, my father never used this machine, so I'm not going to use this machine. We're very quick on adopting new technologies. What about social technologies? It wouldn't be the work of a week to make a system where ordinary Americans could submit their choice for who they'd like to investigate this. And it would quickly end the culture of secrecy, the culture of powerlessness. Now, it's that culture of powerlessness which is being actively debated in the streets, on the one hand by a large number of brave, voluntary participants, and on the other hand by a much smaller number of generally rather cowardly police who would say that they're not voluntary, that they have no choice but to be there. How clear do the government's abuses of power have to be before people say enough is enough? Do we have to wait until it's a global famine before people are engaged enough to say, no, we don't like this, we're going to do things a different way? Seems to me the sooner people can get it together and reclaim power, the easier it'll be for all of us. And on that note, we're going to continue reading, starting chapter 3 of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Chapter 3, Primordial Debts. It begins with two quotes from the Vedic scriptures. Firstly, quote, in being born, every being is born as debt, owed to the gods, the saints, the fathers, and to men. If one makes a sacrifice, it is because of a debt owing to the gods from birth. If one recites a sacred text, it is because of a debt owing to the saints. If one wishes for offspring, it is because of a debt due to the fathers from birth. And if one gives hospitality, it is a debt owing to men. Unquote. Secondly, let us drive away the evil effects of bad dreams, just as we pay off debts. The reason that economics textbooks now begin with imaginary villages is because it's been impossible to talk about real ones. Even some economists have been forced to admit that Smith's land of barter doesn't really exist. The question is, why the myth has been perpetuated anyway? Economists have long since jettisoned other elements of the wealth of nations, for instance, Smith's labor theory of value and disapproval of joint stock corporations. Why not simply write off the myth of barter as a quaint Enlightenment parable, and instead attempt to understand primordial credit arrangements, or anyway, something more in keeping with the historical evidence? The answer seems to be that the myth of barter cannot go away, because it's central to the entire discourse of economics. Recall here what Smith was trying to do when he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Above all, the book was an attempt to establish the newfound discipline of economics as a science. This meant that not only did economics have its own peculiar domain of study, what we now call the economy, though the idea that there even was something called an economy was very new in Smith's day, but that this economy operated according to the laws of much the same sort as Sir Isaac Newton had recently identified as governing the physical world. Newton had represented God as a cosmic watchmaker who had created the physical machinery of the universe in such a way that it would operate for the ultimate benefit of humans, and then let it run on its own. Smith was trying to make a similar Newtonian argument. God, or divine providence, as he put it, had arranged matters in such a way that our pursuit of self-interest would nonetheless, given an unfettered market, be guided as if by an invisible hand to promote the general welfare. Smith's famous invisible hand was, as he says in his theory of moral sentiments, the agent of divine providence. It was literally the hand of God. Once economics had been established as a discipline, the theological arguments no longer seem necessary or important. People continue to argue about whether an unfettered free market will really produce the results that Smith said it would, but no one questions whether the market naturally exists. The underlying assumptions that derive from this came to be seen as common sense, so much so that, as I've noted, we simply assume that when two valuable objects do change hands, it will normally be because two individuals have decided they would gain a material advantage by swapping them. One interesting corollary is that, as a result, economists have come to see the very question of the presence or absence of money as not especially important, since money is just a commodity chosen to facilitate exchange, and which we use to measure the value of the other commodities. Otherwise, it has no special qualities. Still, in 1958, Paul Samuelson, one of the leading lights of the neoclassical school that still predominates in modern economic thought, could express disdain for what he called the social contrivance of money. Even in the most advanced industrial economies, he insisted, if we strip exchange down to its barest essentials and peel off the obscuring layer of money, we find that trade between individuals and nations largely boils down to barter. Others spoke of a veil of money obscuring the nature of the real economy, in which people produced real goods and services and swapped them back and forth. Call this the final apotheosis of economics as common sense. Money is unimportant. Economies, real economies, are really vast barter systems. The problem is that history shows that without money, such vast barter systems do not occur. Even when economies revert to barter, as Europe was said to do in the Middle Ages, they don't actually abandon the use of money. They just abandon the use of cash. In the Middle Ages, for instance, everyone continued to assess the value of tools and livestock in the old Roman currency, even if the coins themselves had ceased to circulate. It's money that had made it possible for us to imagine ourselves in the way economists encourage us to do, as a collection of individuals and nations whose main business is swapping things. It's also clear that the mere existence of money in itself is not enough to allow us to see the world this way. If it were, the discipline of economics would have been created in ancient Sumer, or anyway, far earlier than 1776, when Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations appeared. The missing element is in fact exactly the thing that Smith was attempting to downplay, the role of government policy. In England, in Smith's day, it became possible to see the market, the world of butchers, ironmongers, and haberdashers, as its own entirely independent sphere of human activity, because the British government was actively engaged in fostering it. This required laws and police, but also specific monetary policies, which liberals like Smith were, successfully, advocating. It required pegging the value of the currency to silver, but at the same time greatly increasing the money supply, and particularly the amount of small change in circulation. This not only required huge amounts of tin and copper, but also careful regulation of the banks that were, at that time, the only source of paper money. The century before The Wealth of Nations had seen at least two attempts to create state-supported central banks, in France and Sweden, that had proved to be spectacular failures. In each case, the would-be central bank issued notes based largely on speculation that collapsed the moment investors lost faith. Smith supported the use of paper money, but like Locke before him, he also believed that the relative success of the Bank of England and the Bank of Scotland had been due to their policy of pegging paper money firmly to precious metals. This became the mainstream economic view, so much so that alternative theories of money as credit, the one that Mitchell Innes advocated, were quickly relegated to the margins, their proponents written off as cranks, and the very sort of thinking that led to bad banks and speculative bubbles in the first place. It might be helpful, then, to consider what these alternative theories actually were. State and credit theories of money. Mitchell Innes was an exponent of what came to be known as the credit theory of money, a position that, over the course of the 19th century, had its most avid proponents not in Mitchell Innes's native Britain, but in two up-and-coming rival powers of the day, the United States and Germany. Credit theorists insisted that money is not a commodity but an accounting tool. In other words, it's not a thing at all. You can no more touch a dollar or a Deutschmark than you can touch an hour or a cubic centimeter. Units of currency are merely abstract units of measurement, and, as the credit theorists correctly noted historically, such abstract systems of accounting emerged long before the use of any particular token of exchange. The obvious next question is, if money is just a yardstick, what then does it measure? The answer was simple. Debt. A coin is, effectively, an IOU. Whereas conventional wisdom holds that a banknote is, or should be, a promise to pay a certain amount of real money, gold, silver, or whatever that might be taken to mean, credit theorists argued that a banknote is simply the promise to pay something of the same value as an ounce of gold. But that's all that money ever is. There's no fundamental difference in this respect between a silver dollar, a Susan B. Anthony dollar coin made of copper-nickel alloy, designed to look vaguely like gold, a green piece of paper with a picture of George Washington on it, or a digital blip on some bank's computer. Conceptually, the idea that a piece of gold is really just an IOU is always rather difficult to wrap one's head around, but something like this must be true, because even when gold and silver coins were in use, they almost never circulated at their bullion value. How could credit money come about? Let's return to the economics professor's imaginary town. Say, for example, that Joshua were to give his shoes to Henry, and rather than Henry owing him a favour, Henry promises him something of equivalent value. Henry gives Joshua an IOU. Joshua could wait for Henry to give him something useful and then redeem it. In that case, Henry would rip up the IOU and the story would be over. But, say Joshua were to pass the IOU on to a third party, Sheila, to whom he owes something else. He could tick it off against his debt to a fourth party, Lola, now Henry will owe that amount to her. Hence is money born. But there's no logical end to it. Say Sheila now wishes to acquire a pair of shoes from Edith, she can just hand Edith the IOU and assure her that Henry is good for it. In principle, there's no reason the IOU could not continue circulating around town for years, provided enough people continue to have faith in Henry. In fact, if it goes on long enough, people might forget about the issuer entirely. Things like this do happen. The anthropologist Keith Hart once told me a story about his brother, who in the 50s was a British soldier stationed in Hong Kong. Soldiers used to pay their bar tabs by writing checks on accounts back in England. Local merchants would often simply endorse them over to each other and pass them around as currency. Once he saw one of his own checks, written 6 months before, on the counter of a local vendor, covered with about 40 different tiny inscriptions in Chinese. What credit theorists like Mitchell Innes were arguing is that if Henry gave Joshua a gold coin instead of a piece of paper, the situation would be essentially the same. A gold coin is a promise to pay something else of equivalent value to the gold coin. After all, a gold coin is not actually useful in itself. One only accepts it because one assumes other people will. In this sense, the value of a unit of currency is not the measure of the value of an object, but the measure of one's trust in other human beings. This element of trust, of course, makes everything more complicated. Early banknotes circulated via a process almost exactly like what I've just described, except that, like the Chinese merchants, each recipient added his or her signature to guarantee the debt's legitimacy. But generally, the difficulty in the charterless position, this is what it came to be called, from the Latin charter, or token, is to establish why people would continue to trust a piece of paper. After all, why couldn't anyone just sign Henry's name on an IOU? True, this sort of debt token system might work within a small village where everyone knew one another, or even among more dispersed community, like 16th century Italian or 20th century Chinese merchants, where everyone at least had ways of keeping track of everybody else. But systems like these cannot create a full-blown currency system, and there's no evidence that they ever have. Providing a sufficient number of IOUs to allow everyone in a medium-sized city to be able to carry out a significant portion of their daily transactions in such a currency would require millions of tokens. To be able to guarantee all of them, Henry would have to be almost unimaginably rich. All this would be much less of a problem, however, if Henry were, say, Henry II, King of England, Duke of Normandy, Lord of Ireland, and Count of Anjou. The real impetus for the charterless position, in fact, came out of what came to be known as the German historical school, whose most famous exponent was the historian G.F. Knapp, whose state theory of money first appeared in 1905. If money is simply a unit of measure, it makes sense that emperors and kings should concern themselves with such matters. Emperors and kings were almost always concerned to establish uniform systems of weights and measures throughout their kingdoms. It's also true, as Knapp observed, that once established, such systems tend to remain remarkably stable over time. During the reign of the actual Henry II, 1154 to 1189, just about everyone in Western Europe was still keeping their accounts, using the monetary system established by Charlemagne some 350 years earlier, that is, using pounds, shillings, and pence, despite the fact that some of these coins had never existed. Charlemagne never actually struck a silver pound. None of Charlemagne's actual shillings and pence remained in circulation, and those coins that did circulate tended to vary enormously in size, weight, purity, and value. According to the charterlists, this doesn't really matter. What matters is that there is a uniform system for measuring credits and debts, and that this system remains stable over time. The case of Charlemagne's currency is particularly dramatic because his actual empire dissolved quite quickly, but the monetary system he created continued to be used for keeping accounts within his former territories for more than 800 years. It was referred to in the 16th century quite explicitly as imaginary money, and deniers and livres were only completely abandoned as units of account around the time of the French Revolution. According to Knapp, Whether or not the actual physical money stuff in circulation corresponds to this imaginary money is not particularly important. It makes no real difference whether it's pure silver, debased silver, leather tokens, or dried cod, provided the state is willing to accept it in payment of taxes. Because whatever the state was willing to accept, for that reason, became currency. One of the most important forms of currency in England, in Henry's time, were notched tally sticks used to record debts. Tally sticks were quite explicitly IOUs. Both parties to a transaction would take a hazelwood twig, notch it to indicate the amount owed, and then split it in half. The creditor would keep one half, called the stock, hence the origin of the term stockholder, and the debtor kept the other, called the stub, hence the origin of the term ticket stub. Tax assessors used such twigs to calculate amounts owed by local sheriffs. Often, though, rather than wait for the taxes to come due, Henry's exchequer would often sell the tallies at a discount, and they would circulate as tokens of debt owed to the government to anyone willing to trade for them. Modern banknotes actually work on a similar principle, except in reverse. Recall here the little parable about Henry's IOU. The reader might have noticed one puzzling aspect of the equation. The IOU can operate as money only as long as Henry never pays his debt. In fact, this is precisely the logic on which the Bank of England, the first successful modern bank, was originally founded. In 1694, a consortium of English bankers made a loan of £1.2 million to the king. In return, they received a royal monopoly on the issuance of banknotes. What this meant in practice was, they had the right to advance IOUs for a portion of the money the king now owed them to any inhabitant of the kingdom willing to borrow from them, or willing to deposit their own money in the bank. In effect, to circulate or monetize the newly created royal debt. This was a great deal for the bankers. They got to charge the king 8% annual interest for the original loan, and simultaneously charge interest on the same money to the clients who borrowed it. But it only worked as long as the original loan remained outstanding. To this day, this loan has never been paid back. It cannot be. If it ever were, the entire monetary system of Great Britain would cease to exist. If nothing else, this approach helps solve one of the obvious mysteries of the fiscal policy of so many early kingdoms. Why did they make subjects pay taxes at all? This is not a question we're used to asking. The answer seems self-evident. Governments demand taxes because they wish to get their hands on people's money. But if Smith was right, and gold and silver became money through the natural workings of the market, completely independently of governments, then wouldn't the obvious thing be to just grab control of the gold and silver mines? Then the king would have all the money he could possibly need. In fact, this is what ancient kings would normally do. If there were gold and silver mines in their territory, they would usually take control of them. So, what exactly was the point of extracting the gold, stamping one's picture on it, causing it to circulate amongst one's subjects, and then demanding that those same subjects gave it back again? This does seem a bit of a puzzle, but if money in markets do not emerge spontaneously, it actually makes perfect sense, because this is the simplest and most efficient way to bring markets into being. Let us take a hypothetical example. Say a king wishes to support a standing army of 50,000 men. Under ancient or medieval conditions, feeding such a force was an enormous problem. Unless they were on the march, one would need to employ almost as many men and animals just to locate, acquire, and transport the necessary provisions. On the other hand, if one simply hands out coins to the soldiers, and then demands that every family in the kingdom was obliged to pay one of those coins back to you, one would, in one blow, turn one's entire national economy into a vast machine for the provisioning of soldiers. Since now every family, in order to get their hands on the coins, must find some way to contribute to the general effort to provide soldiers with things they want. Markets are brought into existence as a side effect. This is a bit of a cartoon version, but it's very clear the markets did spring up around ancient armies. One need only take a glance at Cartilia's Arthasastra, or the Sasanian Circle of Sovereignty, or the Chinese Discourses on Salt and Iron, to discover that most ancient rulers spent a great deal of their time thinking about the relation between mines, soldiers, taxes, and food. Most concluded that the creation of markets of this sort was not just convenient for feeding soldiers, but useful in all sorts of ways, since it meant officials no longer had to requisition everything they needed directly from the populace, or figure out a way to produce it on royal estates or royal workshops. In other words, despite the dogged liberal assumption, again coming from Smith's legacy, that the existence of states and markets are somehow opposed, the historical record implies that exactly the opposite is the case. Stateless societies tend also to be without markets. As one might imagine, state theories of money have always been anathema to mainstream economists working in the tradition of Adam Smith. In fact, chartalism has tended to be seen as a populist underside of economic theory, favoured mainly by cranks. The curious thing is that mainstream economists often ended up actually working for governments and advising such governments to pursue policies much like those the chartalists described, that is, tax policies designed to create markets where they had not existed before, despite the fact that they were, in theory, committed to Smith's argument that markets develop spontaneously of their own accord. This was particularly true in the colonial world. To return to Madagascar for a moment, I've already mentioned that one of the first things the French General Gallieni, conqueror of Madagascar, did when the conquest of the island was complete in 1901 was to impose a head tax. Not only was this tax quite high, it was also payable in newly issued Malagasy francs. In other words, Gallieni did indeed print money and then demand that everyone in the country give some of that money back to him. Most striking of all, though, was the language he used to describe the tax. It was referred to as the impôt moralisateur, the educational or moralizing tax. In other words, it was designed, to adopt the language of the day, to teach the natives the value of work. Since the educational tax came due shortly after harvest time, the easiest way for farmers to pay it was to sell a portion of their rice crop to the Chinese or Indian merchants, who soon installed themselves in small towns across the country. However, harvest was when the market price of rice was, for obvious reasons, at its lowest. If one sold too much of one's crops, that meant one would not have enough left to feed one's family for the entire year, and thus be forced to buy back one's own rice, on credit, from those same merchants later in the year, when prices were much higher. As a result, farmers quickly fell hopelessly into debt, the merchants doubling as loan sharks. The easiest ways to pay back the debt was either to find some kind of cash crop to sell, to start growing coffee or pineapples, or else to send one's children off to work for wages in the city, or on the plantations that French colonialists were establishing across the island. The whole project might seem no more than a cynical scheme to squeeze cheap labour out of the peasantry, and it was that, but it was also something more. The colonial government was also quite explicit, at least in their internal policy documents, about the need to make sure the peasants had at least some money of their own left over, and to ensure that they became accustomed to the minor luxuries, parasols, lipstick, cookies, available at the Chinese shops. It was crucial that they develop new tastes, habits, and expectations, that they lay the foundations of a consumer demand that would endure long after the conquerors had left, and keep Madagascar forever tied to France. Most people are not stupid, and most Malagasy understood exactly what their conquerors were trying to do to them. Some were determined to resist. More than 60 years after the invasion, a French anthropologist, Gérard Attabé, was able to observe villages on the east coast of the island whose inhabitants would dutifully show up at the coffee plantations to earn the money for their poll tax and then, having paid it, studiously ignore the wares for sale at the local shops and instead turn over any remaining money to lineage elders, who would then use it to buy cattle for sacrifice to their ancestors. Many were quite open in saying that they saw themselves as resisting a trap. Still, such defiance rarely lasts forever. Markets did gradually take shape, even in those parts of the island where none had previously existed. With them came the inevitable network of little shops, and by the time I got there, in 1990, a generation after the poll tax had finally been abolished by a revolutionary government, the logic of the market had become so intuitively accepted that even spirit mediums were reciting passages that might as well have come from Adam Smith. Such examples could be multiplied endlessly. Something like this occurred in just about every part of the world conquered by European arms where markets were not already in place. Rather than discovering barter, they ended up using the very techniques that mainstream economics rejected to bring something like the market into being. In search of a myth. Anthropologists have been complaining about the myth of barter for almost a century. Occasionally, economists point out with slight exasperation that there's a fairly simple reason why they're still telling the same story, despite all the evidence against it. Anthropologists have never come up with a better one. This is an understandable objection, but there's a simple answer to it. The reason why anthropologists haven't been able to come up with a simple, compelling story for the origins of money is because there's no reason to believe there could be one. Money was no more ever invented than music or mathematics or jewellery. What we call money isn't a thing at all. It's a way of comparing things mathematically as proportions, of saying 1 of x is equivalent to 6 of y. As such, it's probably as old as human thought. The moment we try to get any more specific, we discover that there are any number of different habits and practices that have converged in the stuff we now call money, and that this is precisely the reason why economists, historians, and the rest have found it so difficult to come up with a single definition. Credit theorists have long been hobbled by the lack of an equally compelling narrative. That is not to say that all sides in the currency debates that range between 1850 and 1950 were not in the habit of deploying mythological weaponry. This was true particularly perhaps in the United States. In 1894, the Greenbackers, who pushed for detaching the dollar from gold entirely to allow the government to spend freely on job creation campaigns, invented the idea of the March on Washington, an idea that was to have endless resonance in US history. And that's where we're going to leave David Graeber for this week. We may finish the chapter next week. I see there already is an Occupy March on Washington, and unless the government changes course, I see more and larger marches in the days to come.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep it going.